Bill said, we submitted our self-evaluation report to Distance Education Accreditation Commission. It took about 150 days to evaluate it. They came back to us. They deemed us not ready for a site visit yet. However, they gave us a really good roadmap on what we needed to clean up in order to be able to get ready for that site visit. There was a lot of items in the report where we were deemed fully met standards or partially met standards. There's a number of items where we didn't fully meet the standards, or some items were missing because we didn't have those processes in place. So since then, we've been working on cleaning up those processes or putting those processes in place. We are committed to continuous process improvement, trying to grow the university into a institution, a quality institution that the state can, we can be proud of. We intend to fully comply with anything that's required by DEAC or by the state board. And we're looking forward to resubmitting our report in March. I believe it's on March 19th is when it's due.
Thank you. As I reviewed the material, that I can go ahead and share some of my thoughts, which I reviewed the accreditation materials, the report that you received from DEAC. If you had to summarize the areas for improvement, what would you summarize those to be in your mind?
So honestly, the things that they had concerns about, I wasn't surprised about. There were things that we were working on, but we just couldn't quite get them completely there by the time that report was due. We had a certain time that we had to submit based on when we applied for accreditation. So I wasn't surprised. We had our assessment plan, we had it in place, but we didn't actually have enough data to actually submit some even baseline data. So I wasn't surprised. Obviously, that's a big issue and a big concern, rightfully so. So obviously, that was a big area where we just had a gap. We had a plan, but we didn't have any data. We now have data that we can show that we're going to, you know, make that a part of the university and part of our improvement process, and we're doing faculty training and making sure that all these things are in place. We also didn't have a lot of assessments in terms of student satisfaction survey, things like that. We've implemented one and made changes based on the feedback that we received from our students. So I would say those are the two big areas that I wasn't surprised that we were, you know, deemed not ready, and that we since, you know, made sure work was done.
Okay, so that's good. So, so when I read through it, I had four areas that I recognized. The curriculum processes would tie into assessment, institutional effectiveness, so not only data about the experience in EOX, but also the outcomes, and then library. And those I'm going to lay out because I want to help you understand where I have some concerns later on. Right? when I first, this is kind of funny, but when I first started reviewing your materials, on the very first page of the application form, as I was looking through, I noticed the zip code filled out on the app, and it was 85340. And it made me chuckle because I was like, huh, I live in 85340, and that's Litchfield Park, it's not Phoenix.
Okay.
So then that led me down a rabbit hole of the address. So the address on all of these materials say 1 East Washington Street, which when I put in the address led me to the Kelly Law Team, a personal injury attorney, at 1 East Washington Street, Suite 500, Phoenix, Arizona, 85004. Then I went to your website, and the address listed is not this address that's all over these materials, mm-hmm. nor does the website include the Goodyear facility, if you guys are indeed using that. So it started me off on some concerns when you go back to what you've heard us talk about administrative capacity and having those correct, because I'm assuming this is not correct then, is it?
Well, currently our address will change last week. It was notified that it's changed, and I didn't know how to go about trying to indicate that to this board prior to this meeting. So, but yes, we have since moved to that address. So I didn't know if I was going to have time to do that because I was notified.
Did you submit a change of location?
I didn't, because it literally was, I was told what would have left Friday.
I'm sorry, what?
I just found out about it.
That you were moving?
I mean, that is just our office in which our phone calls come in. It's no one specifically at that sitting there or anything. So the Goodyear office, the Goodyear location of the Goodyear Airport is where we have, you know, an employee or where we conduct training and that kind of thing. That office is sort of where our phone calls and mail are received.
Kelly Law Firm people?
No, that is a building that is partially owned by Regents, and so you can hire offices there, you can hire boardroom facilities there, those kinds of things. That's where the university was originally set up. We did not want to change that prior to submitting for accreditation. We did open up a facility out at the Litchfield at the Goodyear Airport, and we did submit that. I think it's an additional operating location is what it's called. I'm not sure if I have that terminology right, but we did submit for that because we added some classrooms out there and some additional space for instructors. This new facility that became available that is more conducive to the university growing in the future became available to the president, and like Dr. Jamison said, we just found out about it literally late last week.
Well, then how to change the website that fast?
Because on the website, that's it, that's why I mean, I went down this, I was like, so confused. This talks about 2 North Central Avenue. The weird part was I thought I would see the Goodyear, if that's where you're teaching. I thought I would see that on the website, but I don't see it on the website at all. It's not near contact info.
And the rule requires you to submit a supplemental at least 45 days prior, and you have to have board approval before you move.
Okay. I think that's something the president didn't realize. We realized that, and I apologize for not happening out of sequence like that, and we will definitely submit that. We will make changes to the website to indicate that that we have an address at the Goodyear airport location.
So as I traveled in the same box, I started looking at who you guys have named as your local top administrator and saw Dr. Jamison, right? Is that on the application? And so I went to look at the website. And she's not listed anywhere on the like. There's no picture of you when you look at the other deans. It's all gentlemen. Some are deans, but she's not on there. So I thought, and then when I started looking at faculty and the faculty numbers that you guys presented as far as having 8 faculty for both and 8 faculty for degree programs, but you have 21 faculty online. You see, I just started getting concerned because nothing really matches. You know, I can't tie anything out, you know, with what's on paper versus what I found.
That surprises me that she's not on the website because
I think it got removed at some point. And then
this is what you see.
Well, I believe
that. Yeah.
That must have been an administrative mistake because she was on there.
I was on there.
Yeah, and I think you're listed on faculty and listed on this leadership management.
That was.
Okay, so the addressing is just direct. I won't talk about that anymore, but it's pretty much everywhere. And I already talked about the faculty members. So I understand something. Do you have, on the application, it says you have 8 current faculty. That 8 faculty total?
No, that's 8 faculty currently teaching some courses. We have a number of faculty that have developed courses that are ready to teach those courses when the student demand is high enough for those courses to be offered. The courses are ready to go, but unless we get a minimum of about 4 students in a class, it's not financially feasible to offer the class. Those are all elective courses. They're not core required courses. Any core required course will teach that with even 1 student in it.
And then the number of administrators is 3, but if I count here, if you're counting these people as administrators, 4 plus Dr. Jamison, that's 5. So is that what that is? That should be 5, correct? Or if not more, right? Because then you guys talk about a registrar. I think there's a registrar thing in here. Like, so isn't this number supposed to be, would be much higher, correct?
Well, and some of the, I may use the term registrar, but it's actually some of those duties are the same person. So some of that could be that confusion, but I'll make sure that that's clear.
Because we're small, we have a couple of people wearing
right.
2 hats.
Yeah, and I'm familiar. I have multiple positions, too, in my world, but I already knew based on this, even the website, you had 4 people. So unless these people aren't here, and then you were missing, so I already knew that didn't, something's not right there for the number.
We'll clean that up.
Yeah. Okay. down there. No one else has anything they wanted to comment on so far? Okay, great. All right. Okay, so the first thing I'll just say this because when I read through the DEAC report, there are some things that I obviously caught at the same exact time. So one of the first things I had a challenge with was there is no page numbers on this catalog. So there's page numbers in the table of contents, but when you go to try to find the page, you cannot locate it with a page number. And I was searching for something to talk to you guys about, and I couldn't find it again after I read it, and if I could see it in the table of contents. So you guys may want to number that to make it easier for the users. I think we talked about this before, and I think I just have a concern about a statement that you guys made. You've made in the past that you're the first university that has master's degrees in unmanned systems, and then I think now it says you're one of the first. But I just didn't know if you guys found evidence of that, because I guess in my mind, like, you look at Embry-Riddle, they have similar programs. I can't even imagine in my mind that, like, MIT or some of those wouldn't necessarily have had things like this. So.
Yeah.
If you were to make that statement, I would just make sure I have evidence to back it up that it isn't puffery. Right.
Yeah, we did actually come before Embry-Riddle. I've got the evidence to back that up. They do offer a master's degree in unmanned systems now, but they didn't at the time that the university, our university, was started in 2012.
Okay, I would do a complete country check because that wouldn't just be in Arizona. Would caveat that. And in my mind, in how you guys represent your system of quarters versus semesters. So you guys use a quarter time, right? You have four terms a year, and you operate on semesters. And I'll tell you that it does your credits. Your credits are semester credits. It says they're semester credits. And though there are huge factors in that, right? Because in some cases, there's a page, and I'd have to find it, where you say that students should have planned for 10 to 15 hours of work a week. But if they're in a four-credit course, and that's over, it says 10 to 15 hours per week in a four-credit course, but if that's semester hours, they have to do 60 seat hours, right?
Welcome.
You would end up being 15 to 22 if it was depending on a four or a six credit course. So if it seems like you guys
please
are
hold
mixing
while I confirm
them up
your
throughout
question.
The whole thing. It's not consistent. Either you
thank
are
you.
Are
your
quarters
confirmed.
You're going to have to explain this much different because it's different. Right? Whether you use quarters or semesters, the credits matter, all of that. Your programs look like they're in semester credits. Your time is in quarters. So you would have to have more seat time in a quarter term to meet a semester credit amount. Does that make any sense? Alright, so that's throughout everything.
And you might want to just look at, because those words are commonly used, it's not like you're forbidden to use a word, but it really does get confusing. So a semester by definition is 14 to 18, but it's usually 15 or 16 weeks. So if yours is shorter than that and you have it more cadets, that's fine. But I might think of just a different word than quarter, because I do think quarter, I have 4 years, I'll use the word quarter.
Yeah.
But typically, like three quarters is an academic year. So just think about the words you're using, how other schools are using, just to prevent confusion. And the credit, you can only say it's semester credit or quarter credit based on the conversion that you use, so that is the definition that must be used.
Right.
But the whatever terms you choose to use, you just use the word term.
Right? I thought that I caught it and changed all the term. But
you did do a lot of cleaning up, and I didn't notice that. So I went through everything we previously write about.
Yeah.
And you definitely made changes in all of it. But anytime you're editing, you see something again, you look at it again. So you might even want to have someone else read it, or even do a search for the word and just see where you.
Sure, yeah, because we don't want to be confusing or inconsistent.
I was also unclear as the model that is used for this. So when people go to school online, models can look like, for example, correspondence courses where they're doing all the work online, but it's not facilitated to a fully asynchronous this faculty are in there every day model. And like when you go in here and you describe, you know, you'll need to complete assignments on your, instead of having an instructor lead you in a classroom, you will need to complete assignments on your own. And then there'll be other statements where, you know, there is a faculty giving a lecture. So I never quite can figure out what it is this looks like.
It's set up to be asynchronous learning, but we encourage our instructors to spend a number of hours in personal lecture, and we require them to do it a minimum of 4 out of the 12 weeks in personalized lecture, in addition to other ways that they can correspond with the students' feedback, feedback on assignments, on homework, on a weekly basis. And so while the lectures are all recorded and the students can come and go at any time, they don't have to be there at a specific time, we try to get the instructors to make sure that they do have at least one time with the students to spend a couple of hours every 4 weeks, one-on-one FaceTime with the students online. That may be why it's confusing.
So you may want to work on just trying to explain your model more. I would assume VAC would also need to really understand that because of the range, you know, the programs can look like. Okay, so on your admission requirements, so I'm trying to understand, you have a professional certificate. That certificate is at the undergrad level, okay? And then you have master's and doctoral. Are you expecting that students are coming to you only with bachelor's? I was just surprised you didn't have a bachelor's degree. Like, if you're going to do the spectrum, so normally an institution would do the spectrum, right? And you have experience at a baccalaureate level, usually prior to a master's level, usually prior to a doctoral level. But it's kind of like we skipped that bachelor's. So then I was curious.
The logic behind that is that if we wanted to focus on what we're experts in, which is unmanned systems and autonomous systems.
Okay.
So the general education things that you would normally get at the bachelor's level, we're not experts in that. We don't want to be involved in that. So we do expect graduate students to come in with a bachelor's degree. The professional certificates, a high school student can come in and take those courses. They're not intended to be a bachelor's degree program. It's intended to be a vocational, technical, professional certificate that can get them a job in the industry working at that level.
Okay. So on the professional certificate, you said official transcript from all colleges, universities, as well as a high school diploma. Why would you even ask for the college transcripts at all then?
Some of them come in from college. So
we don't, I don't think
but if you're not going to transfer,
no, we don't require.
We require high school
if
transcripts
they have it,
for the certificates.
But it says here, official transcripts from all colleges, universities attended, as well as a high school diploma. Under admission requirements.
You have to have it.
Okay.
I'll just remove that.
Yeah.
I guess to me, it's, if they've gone, then you want it, but you're right, I guess.
But what would make any difference to you, according to what you're saying, because you're not going to transfer in any credits to
the
baccalaureate level, right?
Yeah.
Chances are you're not going to have unmanned.
I think whoever wrote that piece ended up combining it and should be separated out for the certificate program and the graduate program, what the entry requirements are.
Yeah. Okay.
In a previous time, you had a lot of that that had been tangled, and it was improved, but obviously.
There's probably a few things still hanging on that we did fix, and we're happy to fix it.
I think there's ways to simplify your guys' lives. I think that's kind of where I'm going. Is this is made so complicated that you may be unintentionally confusing things. So, for example, I was surprised when I hit the page on admission requirements and I read the master's that there's no GPA requirement on your baccalaureate to get into a master's. Generally, you set one, right? You can graduate from a baccalaureate degree with a 2.0.
Mm-hmm.
In your particular thing, you even talk about how you have a higher level of math requirement in your master's degree. So I would think that you would be setting something like a minimum GPA for entrance as a 3.0, which I think is usually typical. But you didn't set that. But then on the next page, so I would expect to see that in here.
Mm-hmm.
A bachelor's degree with blah, 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 whatever it is you're requiring. On the next page, in academic credentials, which is further down, then it starts to list applicants must have maintained a minimum grade point average of 3.0 in the last 60 semester credit hours or for undergraduate coursework. So I would suggest to you to take this out and put it in there with the other piece, because I literally was surprised you weren't requiring it up here. And I will just say, I think you guys, you're making your life so complicated. Because when you say that you're going to look at the last 60 credits of someone's baccalaureate degree for entrance, you must be doing a hand calc as far as what that GPA is. And I have no idea why you would do that. That is a lot of work. So my professional recommendation is just to set a GPA and call it a day.
I like it.
Because, and you do it on your master's too. And what I was surprised, because master's degrees can be a minimum of 30 and they go up from there. So if I come in with a master's degree of 30, you're going to take the GPA off of there. But if you come in with a master's degree of 45, you're literally going back to look at those last 30 of that 45. And I'm not sure what the purpose of that is, right?
I see your point. That's a good point. Thank you.
Okay. There's a section called Doctorate of Science. I've never seen it that way. But anyway, transfer credits maximum. In the text below that, you talk about how you can transfer up to 16 semester credit hours. But in the table right below that sentence, you say 12. So can you transfer in 16 or can you transfer in 12? Because they're right, literally smack dab in the same section. So you want to look at that? I think you're missing a lot of explanation on how to do certain things. So transfer credit evaluation, I'm not sure how they submit anything. It says that it has to be approved by the dean or the provost, but it doesn't talk about what the role they do. Did they order their transcripts? Do you order their transcripts for them? I'm not sure what happens. Like, what is the process that students would have to follow? I don't know where they find that.
I think it's defined in the student. The initial documents for the student enrollment agreement that tell that the students are the ones that are responsible for having the transcripts sent to us.
Okay, so then is it all, once they send in their transcripts, you automatically putting those through an evaluation process to see if they want transfer, or do they have to ask you to look at it?
No, they ask the enrollment advisor if they want transfer credits, and then we evaluate them.
Okay, so you may just want to. This is your document with all your policies and stuff, and then I would probably add it then.
Okay.
There's a section called enrollment process, and it says upon receipt of all the admission materials and payment of application fee, prospective students will be notified of their acceptance into the degree program by formal letter sent by email. After the admission materials are reviewed, the student will be contacted by email to communicate acceptance into the program. So is it after receipt of all the admissions, or is it after their review? Because you have two sentences that are almost exactly the same, but have two different things indicating when they're going to get their acceptance. So I think you're probably look at that again. I thought this was interesting, because I actually don't know where you're going with this, but under denial of admission, it says if the university is unable to meet the educational needs and objectives of the applicant, and then it says, but the applicant can apply a year later. What would lead to this? I don't understand. It's a very short paragraph. It just says an applicant may be denied admission if unmanned vehicle university determines that the university is unable to meet the educational needs and objectives of the applicant, but they can, after 1 year waiting period, this may apply again. So I'm not. I couldn't figure out academically. You don't have a GPA. How would that? Where would this come in?
I'm not sure what the intent of that particular statement was at this time. That may have been a holdover from the previous owners of the university. I suggest we just take that out.
One of the things I think has worked well for me in my career is just sitting down with these people and getting everyone on the same page and going through policy by policy by policy by policy to review what you've done and say, does this still work? Does this apply? How does this work? Is it going to make sense to anyone who's reading it that's not us?
Believe it or not, we have tried to do that.
Because in the next one, there's another thing that happens throughout this entire document, which is the time that a student has to complete a program changes all over the place. So in one, it is really mostly around doctoral where I notice it. So in some places it'll say you complete your doctoral degree as soon as 2 years, a maximum of 10. In another place, it says a maximum of 3 to 6. It's just not consistent. Some of it's under enrollment period. Some of it, maximum of 3 to 6 years. There's some under satisfactory academic progress. I can give you my edits. They're just, it's everywhere.
Okay. That'd be great.
I didn't understand under tuition where it talks about tuition period is 3 years from the first enrollment date. So in my mind, when I picture how you operate your program, you're operating in a term of 12 weeks, correct?
Right.
And the student is taking one course during that 12 weeks, are they not?
Sometimes they take two.
So I couldn't, based on your statements, I couldn't tell, are you thinking that it's like equal payments monthly over 3 years? Why wouldn't it just be they pay their tuition for the courses at the front end of the term? Because it literally says tuition period is 3 years from the first enrollment date. And here, you know, here's the interesting thing. What about that student that's taking 6 years?
No,
they only pay 3 years of tuition and then they get free for the rest of the time.
No, they typically pay for a course as they go.
So you'll definitely want to scrub through this with that, because that's not the picture I got at all. Which led me to a whole bunch of questions about your doctoral program, which we'll get there. But hours of operation. So the hours of operation that you list is 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So then I was like, well, with that, you're here. Like, everyone's here, right? So wouldn't that make your hours 6 or 7 a.m. to 2 or 3 p.m. every day? And is that accurate?
Probably not. You know, because we've got students literally from other countries, you know, and we're 95% a distance learning institution, we're operating a lot of times 24/7.
In some ways, so I would look at that. And that's what I was suspected. I would just have been surprised if those were your hours of operations. I think they're bringing to your attention. The other thing I would suggest is whenever you make a policy that says that someone is going to do something, a particular title of a person is going to do something, I'd always add or designee. You guys had that throughout here, and that means literally complaint committee will happen when you as the provost do not make a decision and you have a designee because you're out sick or on vacation, and then they'll say you didn't make it.
Can I make one comment on the hours? If you have people all over the world, actually even all over the country, putting your hours in Eastern Standard is actually, or just Eastern Time, is really helpful because of how Arizona messes up. it's just confusing. So like I set all my meetings Eastern Time.
You do.
So it's fine having Eastern Time, just make sure that it's the accurate time.
Can a student finish a term earlier than 12 weeks? Can a student finish a class earlier than 12 weeks?
It's never happened.
Okay.
Never had a request for a student to do that.
It's a work provided weekly, so it has to spread out over 12.
And if they need an I or something, and they ask who the faculty assigns them. You have an inactive status, and in two different places, I think it was confusing to me, because in the event that the university fails to receive coursework from a student within an 8-week period, they would be inactive. But in somewhere else, it said they had like 21 days or something. So you need to go through and check your terms again. I also do not believe that your grading system is correct. How you associate it with a GPA. So on here, you associated an A plus with a 4.0 from a 97 to an 100. But an A is equivalent to a 4, a B is equivalent to a 3, and a C is equivalent to a 2, a D is equivalent to 1. But by the time I got down to a D, which I was checking, I'm at a 1.5 on your scale. So I think you need to double check this because it's not correct. Okay, that's not how it would come out on a transcript. Under under student privacy rights, so you're talking about FERPA, but you're missing a whole bunch of things that FERPA requires, such as what if you guys designate as directory information? How does a student have the right to inspect records? You just need to go on and get all of the required language, they put it on the website and fix your policy. Then you have non-discrimination, but it says, you know, you don't discriminate, but it doesn't tell you what to do if a student feels like they want to report something. It doesn't tell you a process for that. And then, so I couldn't tell, is your registrar also the 504 coordinator? Because it talks about how they submit their documentation to the registrar. Oh. So I think you actually are supposed to call out who a 504 coordinator is, so if you do not have that designated, especially on your website, I would do it. Okay, so let's talk about doctoral, because this is where, when I read through the little stuff in here, you require a dissertation, correct?
Yes.
Okay. But I didn't read anything about, you know, how do you select a committee, and when I went to the DEC, they reported a lot of it, so I have a lot of the same concerns. What does the committee make up? Do you have a methodologist? How do you guys have chairs? Do you have enough chairs for your students? Do you have templates for what you expect the dissertation to come out looking like? What about form and format? Do you have someone checking form and format? If you have someone checking form and format, you might want to run this through them, because it gives another set of eyes we're talking about. They're already doing stuff like that anyway. Are they required to publish it in ProQuest? Do you have a residency requirement? I saw library got hit on here. So I have concerns about the capacity to do doctoral work based on even what DEC saw and what I've seen in here. So I just
dissertation manual, and I mean, it did hit us hard, but it actually, most of it was in our dissertation manual. For some reason, they didn't see it or something. But I don't know that I have the full amount of language in the dissertation manual with this document, but I'm happy to add whatever.
You can reference it. You don't have to. Sometimes when you put things in different places, then you change one, you get changed the other.
I know. Yeah.
So you could reference it and let them know, you know, which is the link.
Okay. And then I would have made me think there was more. Now, I mean, I'm basing off of, okay, I don't see enough here to support doctoral programs,
right?
And how
we have all of that
intensive those are.
In a manual, but not in this document.
I'm assuming you want to see the dissertation.
I think that would probably be a good idea. Just so I can look at it. Help me.
Can I ask, is there, obviously there's so many, and I have a few that are, not quite as high level as yours. Do you think that maybe we should get all of these to you, give them an opportunity to look at it, maybe postpone to have that back? Because
that's where I would start to go.
There's all really, really good.
But there's so much.
It just sounds like so much that it would be asking the staff too much to have to go through and do it. It has to go back through another one level review,
as well as they need to get the report to DEAC. They should go through and clean all of this up for DEAC.
And all this will help you in that. Like, we're always very worried about making like double work, doing something for us to leave them. But she's actually giving you like free consulting here.
Yeah, and we appreciate the thorough review and the feedback. It will help us.
And the whole thing about reading through, like some of mine, I'm looking at, you know, I haven't gone through. Program. I'm looking at more pure consumerism. You know, I'm the public member here, so like if I want to go, or my child want to go, and you do have some things that are, you know, missing or don't make sense. And sometimes when you really worry about this level, you miss like, does that sentence make any sense? So I think that maybe if you could provide your notes, I'll provide your notes.
Yeah.
She will get them to you, and then the next, and then the next meeting would be April 26th. So that way, hey, perhaps this would be the time for you to make a motion to just postpone.
Can I just make one more thing?
Certainly.
When you go through your catalog, I would also check to make sure that things are appropriate for the audience that this is intended. You have in here an instructor's conflict of interest policy, which I find inappropriate in a catalog geared towards students. That would be more geared towards faculty, faculty handbook, and employee handbook, something else. But to put that out there like that, I think it's just odd.
What's it called?
Instructor's conflict of interest. Other than that, I have a motion to postpone.
I second. Any further discussion? All right, I'll vote for that.
Aye. Aye. We'll get this within a week. Hopefully we can get the information.
Maybe. I'll try.
Well, we will try to get it to you, but you'll have to review it.
As soon as possible, because we do need to make those changes before we submit.
Well, we appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks very much for your review.
I just gave up though.
The next order of business is... The initial degree granting license application, administrative office only of the American College of Medicine.
We also have our colleagues calling in on the conference line, our president and dean of admissions.
All right, is there anyone on the phone?
I think they just... Was that the noise?
Bonjour.
I am assuming it would be Dr. Duran and Mr. Perchick.
Exactly. Yes, we're here on the conference call.
Okay.
Dr. Frost, Duran, and Perchick.
Okay. And are you Rose?
I'm Rose.
Okay.
Great to meet you.
Okay. Thank you.
Did I make you the first one?
Yes.
This is pathogenic specialist.
Right.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the board. The applicant of American College of the Mediterranean is seeking what will be a conditional degree granting license to operate out of state, but that doesn't apply, out of country institution operating an administrative services center here in Arizona. Obviously, I had not encountered this type of application before. Frankie and I have spend a great deal of time on this. We've been on conference calls with the department and with the institution to try and sort through and figure out the appropriate type of licensure. It is important that you understand that if ACM was established in Arizona by its parent company, the Institute for American Universities, who is in France, but to recruit here in Arizona for Arizona students and U.S. citizens. The way I understand it is correct. You, in the past, you've worked in conjunction with like ASU, U of A, or whatever, and those students, the juniors and seniors, have come over and completed study abroad. So this time, instead of doing the last 2 years, it would be the whole full thing. But, somebody said
something? So I think that's correct.
Okay. So it became interesting when they first applied. I felt sorry for them. It was two or three of those because we didn't understand, and they filled out all the applications for a program with the program for the study group. But we're not doing the programs. The programs in France, the faculties in France, the centers in France, and but and only because they are recruiting here, is licensure required. If I also understand correctly, if it is their intent to go Title IV, Title IV for foreign institutions does not require state licensure, which that makes sense because it's not for the credits. They do, nor is accreditation, if I'm correct. However, a lot of the institutions in Europe and so on have sought and are accredited by New England. That I can't tell you why. I don't get that. But that is what I understand them to do. So, long story short, after many months, this is why they are here for the physical presence. I could have gone on. I could have gone a lot. And Trish, Miss Leonard, is your lead. Because she was involved on one of the phone calls here.
So do you want to give us a brief statement?
I knew let Carl. Carl, can you hear me? You might want to give a brief statement from before.
Sure. Thank you, Terry, for that recap. That is absolutely correct, everything that you said. I just wanted to thank everyone for looking at our application today. It's been over a year in the making because originally we were under the impression we needed a state license to grant degrees, and it turns out we don't because we are a foreign institution and we are already approved by the French Ministry of Education. But our 501c3 is registered in the state of Arizona, and our board members are in the state of Arizona, and that's why we sought state licensure to begin with. So now we are applying for licensing just for an office to allow us to be in compliance with your organization and with the state and be able to recruit students from the state of Arizona for degrees with the purpose of granting degrees in France.
So I have a few questions. First, we want to make sure that it is very clear to everyone that we are not actually licensing the programs, and the degrees will not be Arizona degrees. So we're licensing the call center. So we're really concerned with the consumerism of, you know, what you're putting out there to the students. We don't have any authority or jurisdiction over the programs, although obviously we trust and hope that there won't be issues with us. So some of this could be a bit of terminology, but I found differences in how things were worded in conversations and in the paperwork about whether you will be a foreign institution or whether you are a U.S. So there were some comments that Mr. Gerben said it was not a foreign institution, but a U.S. college in France. What is the difference between those two?
Maybe some of the literature you saw have to do with our parent organization, the Institute for American Universities, which is a 501c3 registered in the state of New York. And you know, the reason, there are historical reasons for why these organizations were registered in New York or somewhere else. This goes back to 1957 when our parent company, IAU, decided to work with the state of New York and through the regents of the State University of New York to be recognized and do study abroad programs in France and Spain and England at that time. But it was an institute for Americans, and that's why it was referred to that way, and that's why the literature that you read might express itself that way, that it is an American-style college, an American-style liberal arts college. And we use that terminology mostly for accreditation purposes because the accreditors, especially in the New England Association of Schools and Colleges, when they give U.S. accreditation, they want to be assured that the type of education you're giving students is indeed an American-style liberal arts education. And so they asked us to make sure that that language is in our literature and very relevant to the type of students that we recruit.
Okay, well, what I'm referring to is there's an email from you where you say it is not a foreign institution but a U.S. college in France. That's what you said in your email. So really wasn't
that's when we were that's when we were applying for state licensing in the state of Arizona. We're not having that conversation anymore. We're just after the licensing for an office in Arizona.
All right.
We were under the impression we got legal advice from Dwayne Morris that we needed a license in the state of Arizona. And that's the route we went down first. Your office told us we no longer need one. And under our foreign institution status, we can grant our own degree. So we are an American registered college or organization, but our recognition is in France.
Okay. I didn't see anything that talks about how many people you plan on having at the Arizona site. I'm just curious, do you have numbers for that?
Yeah, for now, there's only one person, and that's detailed in the catalog as well. With the address, there'll be one person, and that's Kirsten currently.
question for you. For the grievous policies, should there should be any qualifier on there to make it clear what it is that they could bring to us for remedy? For student grievances, particularly, we won't be hearing any student grievances that pertain to your curriculum or your faculty or anything like that. You're limited. The only reason they need licensure is because your statute defines operate as basically where you get your students from, where you advertise to, where, you know, who you're marketing to. They're marketing to Arizona specifically, so they do require a license for that. So any grievances that you would hear would probably be limited to your unprofessional conduct as far as, you know, their office administration issues or advertisement issues, things like that. They probably should not be referring in their catalog that this board would handle, I don't know how to refer to it, like an internal grievance that would arise from the students attending the school specifically.
They kind of just like the standard grievance language, and I wondered if perhaps recommendations should be made of wording differently to make sure students understood that if they're a problem with a history professor, it would have to all be handled internally through them, and then whatever procedures are in France. I'm sorry, I have no idea what the French education ministry does with complaints or anything like that, but it would have to be handled over there.
So do you want them to give us a revised grievance policy with this more?
It would probably be better for your students and more clear to them that if they have to air their grievances, this would not be the place unless the issue was directly with recruitment or advertising or anything that was being done right out of the administrative office.
No,
Terry volunteered.
Yeah,
I
didn't
call it publicly.
I'll go do a site visit.
I know, as a chairperson.
Yeah.
The chair of the New England Association is going.
I know. I saw that.
So when we did that, we were a little bit slighted.
I was seriously slight.
I do have a question about the New England thing. That what struck me was why New England? So I know, and now I understand the parent company is in New York, but the institution's registered here. So why New England versus higher learning?
I'm gonna let Carl answer that one as well because he's got precise answers more than I do.
I couldn't hear the question very well. You have. Is the parent company in New York? Why are you registered in Arizona?
I was just curious why you chose or why you're going to be seeking accreditation with the New England Commission versus the Higher Learning Commission when the parent company is in New York. Now I got where New England tied in, but you're here in Arizona,
States.
So then.
New York would be middle
states. Oh, are they middle states even?
Right.
Are they New England? So I don't understand how we got to New England.
Yeah. Because going through the state of New York would only allow us to offer 2 degrees until we are accredited fully. In the state of Arizona, when we were first applying for full licensure, we were told that we were not limited in terms of the number of degrees that we could offer. That was initially why we chose Arizona as a state after we received lots of advice from our attorneys at Duane Morris. That is no longer an issue today since we don't need a license in Arizona. But that's initially why we decided to go to Arizona. And in addition, our board members, as I said, for the American College of Mediterranean, 3 of them have residences in Arizona and have ties to the state of Arizona. And that's one of the reasons we also chose the state to operate. We also have very good relations with Arizona State, University of Arizona, Northern Arizona University that send us lots of study abroad students. And one of our marketing strategies is from our pool of study abroad students, once those students graduate from their U.S. institution, they would come to France for a graduate degree. This has been wildly popular and successful. in terms of students looking for an opportunity to do a graduate degree internationally.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I wasn't referring to the state licensure issue. I was referring to the accreditation choice. So your materials say that you're going to seek accreditation with New England Commission. And yeah. I'm curious as to how, because physical presence is usually one of the things that determines which regional you belong to or you would be going through. So why not the Higher Learning Commission if you're Arizona-based entity?
Yeah, no, it is true that physical presence is one of the determining factors if you are working in that state, but since we are not teaching in the state, and we have no faculty or staff in the state except for the purpose of recruitment, and all of our degrees are conferred abroad, we decided to go through NEAC because of all of the accreditors, the agencies, whether it's DACS or WASC or NEAC or Middle State or any other regional accreditor, NEAC has the most experience accrediting international organizations. They have already accredited 3 or 4 of our peer institutions in what's called the AAIC, that's the Association of American International Colleges and Universities, which includes the American University in Bulgaria, the Lebanese American University, the American University in Rome, et cetera, et cetera. Many of those are accredited through NEAC. And NEAC has a special category in their accreditation process for international schools.
But now I'm just curious, why, if accreditation is not required for Title IV, why have all the institutions gone through the process with NEAC?
Because accreditation allows you to recruit students from U.S. institutions who are concerned with going to a school that is unaccredited. Accreditation gives you academic legitimacy. And so, especially American accreditation, a lot of American students, we don't need American accreditation to recruit European students or North African students. But for American students, accreditation is important. Their parents are still interested in sending them to schools that are accredited and approved and show full compliance with all of the accreditation standards. And it was important for us to pursue this because in our organization, in the sort of network of all of our other peer institutions, those schools are accredited, and we wanted to join their ranks of accredited and prestigious schools.
That was a very good answer. That eliminates me asking you a bunch of other questions. So, in the literature we had, there was some mixed information about the parents' school and your school. So, and there was so much stuff to go through, I honestly didn't go back and search. I thought I would just ask you. There's mention of other educational sites outside of France. Are those yours or are those the parents' school?
Which schools outside of France?
I don't know. Somewhere in all of the stuff that I read, it talked about locations other than France where classes were held.
That's just for study abroad. Yeah. IAU has study abroad programs in Barcelona, Spain, and traveling seminars through North Africa, mostly Morocco. But that's not for degree program.
Okay. So then now we'll just get down to some little detail. Because you're actually not really licensed here, the program isn't licensed here. I have a bunch of comments or concerns about the clarity of things in your refund policy, in your catalog, and because we aren't actually licensing the program, we can only ask you to consider clarifying them rather than telling you that you must before we can license them. So rather than going through all of the stuff one by one here, I'm going to provide them to Ms. Sanfeld, and she'll provide them to you. If they don't make sense, you have questions, you can ask back. We're very happy to help. They really were, again, more consumerism in the keeping the eye of having the students understand what these things mean when they sign up, because those are things they'll complain about, which will get them in front of us. Anyone else have anything? All right. motion that we approve the license application for an out-of-state institution operating an administrative services center only, American College of the Mediterranean, and that you maintain a $15,000 cash bond. Do you agree to that?
We're in Washington, D.C. with some meetings and we couldn't show up in person. But thank you again, everyone, and all the best.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Who'd have been with France? That was more exciting than that. All right. The conditional vocational program license application for Arizona Virtual Pharmacy Tech School. Ms.
Dane. Yes, Madam Chair, members of the board. Arizona Virtual Pharmacy Tech School is seeking a Medicare vocational program license to offer an online pharmacy tech program. The owner, it's a school based sole proprietorship owned by Parnell Edwards. He has posted the $15,000 charity bond. Regarding the site visit, we had some issues contacting Carnot yesterday, although Carnot and I have had conversations and he knows me. Basically, Carnot will be operating this as the institution, although the address, it sounds like a street address, it's really a P.O. box, but for licensure purposes, that would be sufficient because, again, it's online, it's in the cloud, you know, you can be anywhere, right? The only issue is the student records. It is our understanding that the student records will also be online.
So we have another school that was all online who required more than a P.O. box, so could I have an explanation why it's okay for the school?
Well, then it means he went, for some reason, because it doesn't, it's not a P.O. box. It actually is a street with a suite number. Well, it is a P.O. box. For some odd reason, it has this. It's a UPS store.
Yeah,
that's a favorite. And that could have been at that point in time. Maybe I didn't understand cloud based stuff, which is a good possibility. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that answers your question. I don't have an answer.
I just thought that's something different about this.
The previous school that was cloud-based was actually a hybrid program.
Oh, that's right. He said he has hybrids.
Okay, he taught some other classes here. My only concern is I think you still have a requirement for on-site directorship. I mean, even though all the teaching and everything will be in the cloud, you still have to have an office space or somewhere where you're operating the computer systems, if you have a server. If you have a phone, they have to be able to reach you. The location of your on-site direction. Yes. So, I guess...
This is walking school.
You are the walking school, but there still has to be a physical...
Well...
This is a P.O. box. Where are you actually operating your school from?
First of all, like Terry already said, my name is Carnell Edwards. I'm the owner of the school. Good answer to your question. And as far as where I'm located, as far as the school, it also operates through an app too. But as far as security, I think I talked to Keith about it earlier. That was yesterday. Mm-hmm. As far as security, as far as students' records, I would say most of the time I do most of my work. That'd be my parents' house. They have a study. It has a lock on the door. So, and their only one there is medium idea. So that's where I do most of the work. But I also stay in the department too. I have also the department. So when I'm there, the department exists myself.
That's what you would use as a physical address.
Where
do you, wherever you do
but one of the things here, though, as far as the physical, I do understand what I'm saying. I don't have a brick and mortar. So I'm not trying to have a brick and mortar.
Yeah.
So there's no brick and mortar. So it's going to operate. You guys say, like, I'm talking about the internet, I'm saying the cloud, you got to think about that. You know what I'm saying? As far as coding, I know a lot about computers, I do code myself. The thing about one thing I do want to say is, as far as the server, it's going to be a very, very secure server. But the main thing I do want to also say too is as far as what you're saying, I can access student records from like either my apartment or at my parents' house or I can even get my phone. But the main thing is as far as student records. It's going to be housed on the cloud. That's where they are.
So I would say the PO box is fine as the public address of record because of
the public. Yeah, because I didn't
want to. Yes. However, I think as an alternative, you should have either in the apartment
that's
or
fine,
your
that's
parents,
fine.
One of
that's,
two
that's, that's
as your physical.
I don't want to hear the deal because it's online. It's an online program. And I don't know. I'm saying, let's say that. I want to let my parents, they have to come to inspect, so they want to see, it's the first student record, how I'm accessing, the program. They can come over and they can check and see how I'm on the computer. They want to check my software. They want to see if I got virus protection, that type of stuff, is for forcing the records, are they secure? That's fine. But as far as the school, I don't want that view to that address to be available to the public.
Yeah, and so for public record purposes,
right.
Get your home of your apartment address.
I'm going to use my parents' address. So
okay.
For
one in Yuma?
Yeah, one in Yuma.
Perfect. Yeah, that would be great. Okay, so there's your physical presence.
It's not
Apple.
Yes. It's not an Apple.
And, like I said, the difference between this and your other case is that it's not a hybrid program, it's a solely online program.
Mm-hmm. And someone's here.
I assume there was a difference, but I just wanted to make sure that I understood it, because that made a pretty big difference.
And the board member lead is Mr. Lukey.
Yes. Well, belated welcome. Mr. Edwards. Glad you're here. Save the best for last. Well, this is... quite a labor of love that you put together. You obviously must love pharmacy.
I do love pharmacy. I've been in pharmacy 24 years. I've been a pharmacy technician 24 years. I've been devoted my life to pretty much the pharmacy.
Fantastic. Yes. All right. Well, we just have each of us probably have some questions, and I'll just kind of lead out a few. You've submitted your own financial statement. Will you have any other investors or any other capital money to be able to operate to get the school off the ground?
That's a good question. Okay, so good, very good question. As far as right now, I don't have any as far as investing right now in my company. Probably my main investor right now will be my father. He's a millionaire. My dad has money, he has a lot of houses. So he along the way he has helped me with other as far as expenses and stuff. But my dad, I don't list him as a as an investor, but my dad is a millionaire, and he has a bunch of houses in real estate. But so I, as far as the school, and one of the thing is, as far as my program, I've listened to some of the schools before this meeting, many schools one of the schools I'm saying names are in debt. But I think one of the biggest problems with schools, I see a brick and mortar. I don't have a building. So I think that's one of the good things when it's all on the cloud and the internet. So as far as my expenses in school, it's pretty really really low.
Your intention is to start with one or two classes this year.
You say one or two classes?
I wasn't sure if it was clear as to you were budgeting to have one or two classes this year.
Yes. As far as, my wife, you say, when you say classes, you mean program?
Are you going to have like a group of students that you're going to start all at one time?
Right.
So what are you envisioning in terms of how many you can accommodate online?
As far as the number, I'm saying like other pages. Let's say a projection. We don't really have a, I'm saying like as far as a projection. I'm thinking about 10 or 20 students when we first start. We're going to be a real, right now, it's a really small school right now. So I don't see anything major right now. I'm thinking about 10 or 20 students per, per program.
And are you familiar with the term synchronous and asynchronous delivery systems?
Not.
So synchronous would be you and I are going to have a scheduled time where we meet consistently and you get your education on a regular schedule. Asynchronous is I get online, you're sleeping, I'm in New York City, and I'm in my pajamas, and I can do my education whenever I want. So do you envision delivering your online program on a schedule, on a consistent schedule?
It's going to be very flexible. So it's going to be modules that you have to take. Modules. It's going to be webinars. There's webinars. There's also, like I said, there's modules. There's webinars. As far as the student reaction, for a student, if they have a question about, it could be a question. They can email the student, so far as the question. But as far as that they can go, they can kind of go on their own pace. That's how it's set up.
Okay. So we'll check the box asynchronous. It's gonna take quite a bit of marketing to get this off the ground. How do you plan to market your school?
Okay. I do have a degree in marketing. So as far as marketing. Most of it's going to be digital marketing is what I'm going to do. So I was looking to a school earlier. I can't believe it. If they spend like millions of dollars on, on marketing.
Just 4.7.
Okay. So, that's not going to be my school.
Don't let that.
That's a lot of money, but I'm saying. But it does take money to make money. So, there is going to be some marketing. As far as that budgeting, we're going to take it kind of like, I'm going to kind of go. So when I first start off, I'm going to be very, very modest in the beginning. If I have to invest some money into the school as far as marketing, and actually pick it up. But I'm not even spending that kind of money, like $4.7 million on marketing. We're small. That's a big school, though. We're small school. That's
something.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money.
I think that's the board likes your answer. That's okay. A good idea. So on admissions, there's a student that's interested in like to take advantage of what you have to offer, you'll be doing the enrollment process, I assume, online or in person?
Okay, it's going to like, the way it's going to start, there are two main, The way it works is that we actually work with CourseStorm, so they go to CourseStorm for the registration. So as far as CourseStorm, that's going to be like, as far as CourseStorm, that's where they go enter their name, their date of birth, personal information. And so once they go in the database, we can go on there and then we have to verify that information. So that's the way it works. So the way it works first, we go to the main website. That's going to be www.abcps.com. So they go there, and there's a link that's going to link them to actually, it's going to enroll now. Now it should bring them to actually CourseStorm. So when they go to CourseStorm, from there, they'll enter personal information, their first name, last name, date of birth, all the information that we need. And then if it's a good match, and we say, okay, well, this person, we think this person, they can qualify, then we have to send the information to the schools, and they'll verify if that person did get a GED, they do have a high school diploma, and then as far as background check, that type of stuff, it's all done right there.
Let's say I live in Albuquerque. Would I be able to enroll in your pharmacy school?
As of right now, we're only taking Arizona students right now. But in the future, we want to be able to enroll students in Albuquerque. But as far as pharmacy, there are a lot of like crazy rules as far as like the different states. There are actually some states. there are some states that actually don't require, like, you don't have to even be licensed to work in the pharmacy. So that's why, you know, like, just because we're a new school, I didn't want to take on all that right now. But eventually, once we get, you know, like I'm saying, that's something that we want to look into in the future.
So you're quite aware that there's
right.
most likely licensing issues exactly. in each and every state as far as online. So.
I have a question about state, if I could ask them over there. Since you're online, if a person was planning to move here, say, they could do the part online and then move here and do the externship. So you did say in your materials that it's only open to Arizona residents.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that if someone from Albuquerque calls and says, I'm planning to move to Phoenix, the way you worded it in your catalog, you can't admit them. So
well,
just make sure that you're clear that what you say you need to do. So if you want to be more open, you could say that we cover licensing in Arizona, the externships are in Arizona, rather than just saying we don't take anyone out of Arizona. It's completely up to you how you want to do it. Just make sure however you word it, that's what we're going to hold you to. And it's fine either way. It's your choice.
And just, I just realized that there's two entities if you ever try and do another state that you would have to go through the post-secondary as well as any licensure entity. So it's not just one. It would be two.
So you're probably best saying just on Arizona residents. I just want to make sure since you said it, you do it.
I have a question. If we're talking about when you were talking about admission requirements, does able to pass a criminal background check or obtain a fingerprint clearance card, are you checking for those up front? So if someone goes, gets their fingerprint clearance card, you're waiting before they can start to physically have a copy of that fingerprint clearance card in hand?
No, that's not the way we're going to do it. The way it's going to work is, what we're going to do first when they first apply, this is only for the background check. Are you talking about the background check right now? Okay, that's what I'm talking about. Fingerprint clearance like that, what that basically is a background check. So what they do, then we're going to come in first, and we're going to actually check their records and see, and we're going to do a background check on them, and we're going to check and see, you know, like, if they don't have a felony, and, you know, like, or they haven't had any kind of charge. It could be like some type of drug charge. We see something like that, and they're not going to be able to get a license with, you know, with the state board of pharmacy. But that's going to be, so basically, it's going to be a soft, you know, a soft thing. But as far as DPS, if they go to the DPS, because they have a, the DPS uses a fingerprint, they actually, they have a fingerprint thing that goes to FBI, check, they can check through all the states. So what we see, you know, as far as the DPS, I don't know what they may see.
Yeah, so sometimes when you do the federal one, though, the state crime won't show up.
Right.
And so on here, it literally says able to pass a criminal background check or obtain a fingerprint clearance card.
Right.
And so I only want to caution you that, having experience with this, there'll be some cases where certain crimes you can actually have on your background check, and that's okay, and certain crimes that you can't because you can't get them through licensure. Just make sure if you're only going to say that they have to pass a background check, and what does passing a background check mean? Does it mean that there's nothing on there? Does it mean that the crimes that are on the background check can get them through the licensure? Then I would take off the fingerprint clearance card if you're not going to collect that or do anything with it. Right?
If you need it for a job, though, you could say that to get a job in the pharmacy
yes.
generally required to get the fingerprint card. You can also say if you have drug-related felonies, you're not going to get the job. Because we had a case of a student who complained that she had a drug conviction and she had went to school as a farm tech and that she could not get a job because nobody would hire her. And the school was covered, though, because they had clear information in their catalog and something the student signed that said, I understand that jobs in this field are generally not open to people who have certain convictions. And she signed that. And she came back and complained, and he said, you signed it. So just cover yourself.
That's exactly
right.
Yeah.
Okay. Because, I mean, what I'm trying to say there, because, like, you know, that it's funny how, like as far as pharmacy, it kind of goes into, like, both, you know, both, like, both boards. It goes to the board of pharmacy, and also goes to the two boards. But the main thing, like, you can't even walk in, like, you can't even walk into a pharmacy with, you know, with all some type of license. And that's what the pharmacy board. So in order to get that license, they have to have a fingerprint clearance card to actually walk into that pharmacy.
Okay.
Yeah, then you want to specify that, that it's required for the job. So it's not that it's required to go to the school, but if it is required for the job.
And that's what that's what an externship. That's what an externship. So an externship doesn't go through to like that's going to be 12 weeks, but eventually, you know, that's what they want to get to. You know, to
so do they
externship.
Have to have that fingerprint card to be able to work the externship?
Yes.
Okay. Then this has to be clear.
This is my point. Because okay, here's what's going to happen.
I'll make it more clear.
They can't get to the externship because they can't pass the fingerprint clearance card. You don't have all this really laid out. They're going to say they want their money back because you mm-hmm. let them in knowing. I guarantee you 100% that will happen.
So you need to find what
passing a criminal background check means, and then separating, because this is an admission requirement. I would take that fingerprint clearance card statement out and make that a policy that's, you know, it talks about the fact that in order to get employment, you need a fingerprint clearance card, you can't have certain kinds of crimes. I would strengthen those.
Or to engage in an externship.
Correct.
Yeah, you want to keep the eye on, we don't want people to come to the complaint boards, we don't want the complaint committees, we don't want the students to be upset, and we also don't want the schools to be upset, so you want to make sure that everything in your...
On the first page, I would actually explain what the clean clearance card, that's on the first page of the enrollment agreement. It actually goes into it, it tells them what the clean clearance card is, and there's also a checkbox in there for them to check that. Did you guys just see that?
I
didn't define it, what it was and what it is.
I'm looking at program course of study for both programs. And then it lists the admission requirements they give you four. And I would say you probably need to go through the language on this anyway. So it says 18 years of age, comma, high school diploma, comma, GED, comma, and valid ID, which would indicate you have to have all of those, which you're not going to do anyway. You're going to have a high school diploma or GED. So you want to go through it. And then the next line is able to pass a criminal background check or obtain a fingerprint clearance card. And that's all that says.
And
there.
Under there, you see, I think right underneath there, it should kind of define what the actual what the fingerprint clearance card is. Like, I'm talking about the Roman agreement. Are you guys familiar with the Roman agreement?
I'm
going to
add.
I got here, so it's on page 63 of the 119 page.
Okay.
I think the point is, you do call it out here from that piece in the start of the externship, but they've already started school.
Yeah.
And I think that's the point of clarity and opportunity. If they go far and then they are unable to obtain, what could be the recourse?
So basically, I can add a clause to, you know, I guess put something in there to, you know, so I guess put something in the contract that's going to say that, you know, if they don't, because it could be a student that actually gets accepted to the program, but if they try to apply for a fingerprint clearance card, they might not be able to get through. That's what I'm saying. So make it a little more clarity that way. That way, if they actually get accepted in the program, but they still can't get a fingerprint clearance card, they won't be able to get a job. Could it make more specific?
So if you have it on the EA, just make sure that any statement you make on the EA should also be found in the catalog. The catalog is the entire agreement with the student, and the EA is a subset.
Okay.
So it does look like you explained it better in the EA than you did in your catalog.
Oh.
Right?
Well, and I would just say that the sentence that I would be concerned about, a person seeking employment, licensing, or admission to college, university, or educational program may be required to apply for. What you're saying is they would all be required to.
They have it.
Okay,
so it may change.
Yeah,
you
got to change it anyway.
And then this, we should probably put this, do a cut and paste and put it in the catalog.
Yeah.
Because this is that.
We'll do that.
Okay.
I'll clarify that.
And then I still would go back and define what passing a background check means as far as what you can see on it. You're going to see lots of different things that you're not going to.
A lot of complaints about externships.
that schools overpromise and they don't have attendance. So when you enroll students, you need to be sure that you have enough external sites that if all of them successfully make it through the program, you would be able to get all of them an externship, that there are enough choices. And some of the issues that we've had is the school might say, yes, I have enough, but they were all like way in the East Valley, and they were hiring people that were way in the West Valley, and the people had no means of getting there. So just be aware that externships is going to be the bane of your existence with students if you don't have it, you know, really prepared for that. So I know she has some things there about Walgreens. So Walgreens are everywhere. So if that's a deal that they are likely to be able to get one of Walgreens, you know, closer to their home, that's great. And make sure you're not making promises that you can't keep, like, oh, we can always get you an externship that's in, you know, 10 miles of your home or something. And I'm saying this because we've actually had this happen. Students have come in and said, I was told I would be able to get one on the bus route. And then the school said, well, we said we'd try. Students said, I wouldn't have signed up because I know I don't have a car. You know, so just watch for those things. And then in your grievance, this is a little hard because you're the only guy. But we usually want them to say, or designee, so you're out. So if you decide to go to France and check out these guys from his last school.
With us.
With us, yes.
And you're the only person, I think. I've other people that's involved in school.
Okay, so you could, because what the point I was making is that if you want to go to France for 3 weeks, you would want to have someone else be designated to do things that you're assigned. So just make sure anywhere you have an exact title, like in the grievance, that you just say, or designee, and that just allows you to give someone else that hat while you're not available. So that's all it is, because we literally had a complaint that the thing said it was like a dean was going to approve it, and the dean's assistant did it, and the student filed a complaint saying it wasn't you who did it.
My question is that, you know, my grievance policy, I list Michael Bundy as a person that he can handle that. I thought that's pretty laid out. But I see what you're saying, though. I can just, I guess if he's
Mike Bundy
or designee.
Or
designee.
Yeah,
that way, he's not there.
Or you
title.
Person.
Okay.
Title
or
designee. Okay.
Was it,
do not list the person's name.
Yeah, you're restricting yourself too much.
Okay.
Yeah, like what if he quits? He's the only guy. Now you can't comply with the grievance.
I see what you're saying.
Advisor or designee, president or designee.
Yeah, so whatever his title is, if he doesn't have one, give him one. And then put it in there and then say or designee. So that would mean he gets to go to France instead of you. and he can designate somebody else. In your admission, you don't have to, but you might want to consider putting the high school graduate, GED, or equivalent, because there's a lot of homeschoolers, and especially with having online, you might have people attracted to you who have done homeschooling, and the homeschool diploma is just like this weird thing about whether it really is technically a high school diploma, so you're covered by saying or equivalent. And then in the program requirements, all I saw it talk about was that it's all online. So page 6 of the catalog, it says it's all online. And elsewhere you talk about the externship, but that's kind of a misstatement because the entire program is not online because they have to do the externship. So you might want to clarify that to just explain that the classroom portion is all online and the externship is separate. Just because when people are looking at this, sometimes they just latch onto that and say, I saw it said all online. Now he's telling me I have to go to Walgreens down the street. So just be careful. So that's page 6 of your catalog. That's all I have.
I just saw one other thing I would just like throw out there. You have a student services page.
I do.
And it has a list on page 5. And you list other entities outside of yourself as student services, like the Arizona State Board of Pharmacy and Arizona Private Public Secondary. I would just caution you, maybe not to list under student services, as if they're helping you in that capacity, they'll start calling. And then you get lots of complaints from those entities about how students are contacting them. Where you have to put in Arizona Private Public Secondary in the policy as far as oversight and stuff, do that. But this looks like you can call them on behalf of you guys. You know what I'm saying? I guarantee you students will start calling these people thinking they're going to help them with something for your school.
So take off the posting their education out of student services.
I would take out the state entities for sure. I mean, you want to put in the Arizona State Board of Pharmacy if that's if you're going to direct them to licensure afterwards and that's where they have to go, then I would have it in the licensure section and say this is who you're going to get it from. But I certainly would put them under student services as if they're a student service of your school.
Could put it in there for and leave it. I don't know what it's called, student services.
Under resources.
Resources.
Are a common place to put it.
But you have Core Storm in there. You have you guys in there. Those are home. Students are home. And I would just say to you, it would be good to apply for that.
You get that though.
Anyone else have any questions, concerns?
I move that we grant a conditional license and that school maintains their surety bond of $15,000.
Okay, we have a motion second. Any further discussion? Do you accept those terms?
I do.
Great. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Motion carries. Good luck.
Thank you.
For now, we'll quickly beginning next week to get some of these changes done.
Sounds good.
Okay. All right. The next order of business is call the public. Do you want to stay and be the public? He's booking it out of here. We had some when she left. Thank you very much. So there are no publics, so for the record, we're down that. Board business, the executive director of the board. Ms. Smith.
I don't have anything to add to my report. Does anyone have any questions? Okay, I'll give you an update on House Bill 2302. That is a bill that was introduced by Representative Thorpe. First, it was a bill by Representative Thorpe where it just changed your terms from 3rd January to 4th. Then all of a sudden, the strike, everything came in. And those are always scary. That was also from Representative Thorpe, and it was two paragraphs and added language that the school who is exempt by the board could opt in regulation. But paragraph B was our authority was limited to student grievances. Oh, I about had a coronary. And so I called finally got through Representative Thorpe, and he explained to me he was doing it because a constituent of his, Indian Bible College in Flagstaff, who is exempt from us because of religious solely in nature, could not get Title IV because they're not licensed by us and they didn't have a grievance procedure. So they had asked Representative Thorpe to help them, and his way of helping them was to do this. And I said, well, that's fine. After Frankie, however, that means nothing. You know, if you're licensed by a board, I said, you can't pick and choose. And so I had a fairly long conversation with him. And then he asked me to call the school and Flagstaff. So then I called the school and Flagstaff, spoke to them, and explained to them, well, if you ever got audited and found out that if a student would come to us, I'd say, sorry, can't help you, because we have no enforcement authority. So it really meant that you really didn't have grievance procedure, so it was really worthless.
Did they contact Department of Ed to find out if they had any sort of an exception since there was no state license requirement?
That's the department with that new, with the state authorization, that's the one thing they haven't been bent on. Every school has to have a third party review. So his concern, I found out what his concern was, and we were able to work through it, and we have now sent him the app. So then I spoke with Representative Thorpe. He agreed to put a floor amendment in, which went in yesterday. It now is just plain opt-in. We're not doing it.
Why can't they just, if a religious institution wanted to be covered by the state, why can't they just say, I want to still go through the process, even though they can be exempt? Isn't it can be exempt, not have to be exempt?
It says you are.
So just says you are exempt. So this is just giving the opportunity to opt in, whether it's all in or all out.
Yeah, all in or all out.
So they can't. So this allows them to say, I want to be like. Okay. So that's what I was saying.
He's stuck the second portion, because the second portion
literally limited you to only student grievances.
Which
means so
exactly.
If we had to do our annual review for administrative capability and financial capability, you wouldn't have that ability.
Unless we're
going to
the issues.
Yes, exactly.
That's
what
I was
saying.
And that was the problem with the
Stryker.
So that was good.
So it's been fixed.
It'll now go over to the Senate. I won't, on behalf of the board, I don't usually register a yay or nay. I just keep on watching. The other thing is, I want Kevin to give you an update on our e-licensing, which has taken a great deal of time, all of Kevin's time. We're in with 16 other boards. Supposedly, we are going live March 19th. So, no longer is anything paper. Everything will be through the portal, online, renewals, you go.
Yeah, it's part of the governor's mandate is really for the state to go as digital as much as possible. So last year we were part of this process where we were the first boards to go through, and we worked with Deloitte utilizing Salesforce. I know that some of you have probably used Salesforce before for all of our renewals, new applications, everything. So it has been a lot of configuration and meetings and but by the time we get to mid-March, we'll be 100% digital. That includes all of our old records, too. So not student records, but our old our institutional records. So we have a temporary in there doing a tremendous amount of scanning. All of those documents will be uploaded into the system. We'll communicate to this next group, which are the schools that will be July renewal cycle. So we notify them in March. They will go through the process and be the first 40 schools that will go through and learn how to do this on digital format. It's going to be great, I think. It's been a lot of work, but it's really once we teach the schools how to log into the system and use it, it's going to be a huge time saving for us at the staff level. And the programs, when you've got Grand Canyon, you've got U of P with 220 or 250 programs, it's massive.
For a buck.
Right.
You go in and change each program at all 10 locations. That's how it used to be.
Yeah. So this system will put that burden on the school to make those changes. So if somebody wants it, University of Phoenix wants to change it by $1, the labor is going to be on their side to go in and change that 220 times the number of campuses that they have, which are 4 or 5. So, but it's certainly going to be a change because we've been doing paper forever and a day. But you'll have access to it. Each board member will have a component that you'll be able to log in. You'll be able to review basically what you have in front of you now with all of the documents that are there. All of that will be uploaded into the system. You'll be able to review it. You'll be able to see any notes that Terry wants you to see. We'll also do all the complaints. People will be able to file complaints online in the portal, go in and start that process. So it's the next 3 or 4 months are going to be really interesting as we roll it out. But I think that the schools, most all of you already use digital systems and you're trying to eliminate as much paper as you possibly can. So this just puts us in the same category as you at the schools.
So you're doing renewals that way. What about new programs? Do you need guinea pigs for new programs?
We're going to need.
Yes. You never rejected it so far.
Yeah. So will that same process will happen if you want to put a new program in, change of ownership, change of anything that we would normally do.
Everybody.
We can put you in. I think what I'd like to do is certainly identify some schools that are more savvy when it comes to, unlike the horseshoeing school that I did yesterday, some of the more.
Is that putting horseshoes on?
It is teaching people how to. Yeah, it's a farrier school. So. He's been licensed since like 1979 or something like that. So there's schools like that, and then there's schools like yours that are not going to need the same level of hand-holding. So it'd be great to have you be able to go in and test it with us.
Oh, that's okay. You want to pilot.
Yep.
I'll pilot away.
So. Kevin has... I couldn't have done this. You could have picked me up off the street. I couldn't have done it.
Well,
he has spent an enormous amount of
thanks.
Time. Has written
thank
all
you.
The scripts.
Thank you.
When it rolls out, it'll be awesome. He has committed to... He'll go out and handhold with the school
yeah.
if he has to. I mean, he's finally got me, so I have this here.
Have you noticed this? She's been bringing her computer for the last couple.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't have nearly as much paper.
That's never going to happen for you.
She was digitally down. So.
Yeah, I was
until
I got
here.
Like, what's going on?
Yeah.
So when
and
you say you're
going to
be, you have some
out
there with the old stuff, is that you're taking like all the prior applications and scanning them in?
Applications, all of the documents, all of that, and then we will. Right now, they're sitting on our Google Drive, and then they will eventually be uploaded into the system, so that we'll be able to keep track. So that the school, 5 years from now, will be able to go in and look at all of the documentation, look at what that application looked like, the enrollment agreements, all of that will be there. So that all that's all we really have to do is go back in and look at it.
So when we did a project at the school that I used to work at. Had some issues that the person got a little bored and actually put things in, you know, upside down. It was 5 pages and 4 scanned in. So someone doing a QC to make sure that 4 things are destroyed.
Yes.
And sometimes they look like over
every single one. And where I did 46 that I have done 2 years worth of every single folder, like every part of that application has been renamed to the school name, year, and what it is, application, program forms. And I scroll through to look at quality and to make sure they're correct. Some of them I've actually had her scan well because I have Adobe Pro and I can flip it all anyways. So there are some blank pages because we're having to do double-sided, which I'm removing as I can. But I currently have over 100 schools I haven't done, and she's still scanning.
Because we ended up saving things for some period of time and have a system.
But she's amazing. She's very meticulous. If she sees something messes up, she cancels the... process. I mean,
yeah.
She is like OCD perfection with this, and I could not love her more for it.
But I'll be able to track everything. I'll be able to track our emails. No, yes.
Track whatever kind of communication that you have with the school.
So, you know, when they say you didn't comment, does that
mean? So, what if you think or email? That's what I'm learning.
Well, you should always want
to
stay
in your emails and
make it a peanut.